The Psychedologist.
Hello, hello. You're listening to The Psychedologist, Consciousness Positive Radio. This episode is a conversation with a person that I love and adore. And we spoke a few months ago now. It took a little while to get this episode up. But it was a conversation with Gina Taccone Moore, and we spoke about consciousness and trauma and a little bit about psychedelics and the mystical experience. A pioneer in the world of manual therapy with knowledge that goes far beyond the four walls that house your primary care physician, Gina spends her time answering mystery pain with the motto, "It's not magic, it's mobility." As an accomplished clinician and businesswoman, Gina has been running her own practice, The Treatment Room, in all of its iterations since 2013. And I met Gina back around that time, probably around 2014 or 2015, when I was doing CrossFit. Aside from working as a member of the medical staff for CrossFit Regionals from 2013 to 2018, she is a renowned consultant for high-profile sports organizations and clients nationwide, including the NFL, MLB, and PGA. Gina's unique approach to pain management and relief is rooted not only in her copious manual therapy certifications, but also in her extraordinary prosection work. Most notably, Gina was a part of the team at Plastinarium Lab in Guben, Germany, that prepared the world's first plastinated model of the human fascial system. Even with this impressive roster, Gina still finds time to pursue her own love for CrossFit, weightlifting, literature, and the art of interior design. There's truly never a dull day in Denton County, Texas, where she lives with her husband, Alexander, and their dog, Dorian. Ugh, I love Dorian. I miss Dorian. I miss Gina. This was a great conversation. I hope you enjoy being a fly on the wall for just a chat and catch up that Gina and I were having one day.
So people nerd out in all different ways about psychedelics. And one way that I've always found really interesting is just in the pure base physiology of it all. And like there are visuals that are quite common, like seeing Aztec type or like alien writings, like strange symbols. And this is really, I've seen it a lot and I can't tell you how many people have seen it and told me that they saw it. But I wonder about like, you know, rods and cones and like, you know, the visual cortex is affected. So it's like, does it make us see something similar in that way? Or is it, you know, and then there's people that nerd out on like archetypal and transpersonal things. And like, these are, you know, this is like written in the collective unconscious of humans. So you're accessing that, or maybe it's something mystical. And so, yeah, I always find that so fascinating. Like, and it's like, what we see is what we see. And then what it means to people is what I tend to focus on when I'm helping folks process is like, what did that bring up for you? You know, because it could be like a mystery or fear or a sense of familiarity and comfort in like belonging in, you know, this weird human earth family that we're on. So, yeah.
Yeah. So that's what I was going to ask was just, you know, my curiosity is leaning towards people's interpretation of what they've experienced. And so, you know, is there a common thread that you notice that people kind of gravitate towards and start to pull after they've seen something specific?
You know, I think it depends on the person. And like, I believe very much in, just put this in. Can you still hear me?
Perfectly. Yep.
So the intention for the journey can certainly come into play in the meaning that we make of it. So what was your question again?
So the question was on seeing, you know, a lot of these common visualizations. So we talked about snakes, we talked about jaguars, we talked about kind of the Aztec, cultural things. We talked about jungles. And my curiosity was in individual interpretations of those seemingly kind of common experience images. Like, what are you hearing from people that connects them to these things that it seems like everybody is kind of seeing, at least in part?
Well, there's often a sense of awe and like not disbelief, sometimes disbelief, just majesty, mm-hmm. like looking at an enormous cathedral or something, or like the edge of a cliff and a huge vista. So there's that sense. You know, I'm not one who experiences a lot of alien type stuff and entity type stuff. I think it would be really cool to experience it. And mm-hmm. I mean, it can be cool, it can be scary for people, but for me, I much more it's interaction with things that I already relate to and know, like plants, and not so much animals, actually, much more plants and like parts of myself, I suppose, is what I end up kind of coming into contact with. But you know, there's two types. I differentiate visions and visuals. So the visuals are like, if you close your eyes, it's the images that you're seeing. You know, it will be probably a lot clearer than this, but kind of like when you close your eyes and press on them gently and it makes all these different colors sort of pop.
Got it. Yes.
Yeah. So there'll be visuals like that. And there are open-eyed and close-eyed visuals. And, you know, in a dark, usually ceremonies are done in a pretty dark room, or people even have eye shades. So you'll open-eyed or close-eyed, you'll be seeing probably colors, and some people don't see colors. I had an epigeneticist on here, Daphne Krantz, and she was talking about how like different MAOI system, like different MAOI levels and types will make people see more things or less things, and strains of mushrooms can apparently produce more visuals, and so there are some additives to ayahuasca that, you know, so different jungle plants that can make things more visual or less visual and more purgative. So that's one thing. But then the other thing that has so much meaning are the visions. And these are more like seeing in one's own, when your mind's eye, you know, someone described recently a visual of seeing their parent with their parent's face on a baby's body. And like, what is more clear than that? You know, like I have seen, I get the idea of that very much, and seeing the little children that my parents still are, and, you know, mm-hmm. the baby that I am and my partner is, like, so these like kind of tailor-made images or scenes, people can see scenes from their past, or they might see scenes. I've seen things that actually happened later, and I'm not saying that I was psychic, but it could be coincidence, but just seeing that made me look out for it. And then when it happened, it was like, oh my gosh. So,
wow.
Yeah.
That's super cool.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And you know, people with the volume turned up,
turned up, and like, but also like the brightness and the contrast, everything distorted.
Yes.
Yeah. And then there's also the somatic, different somatic experiences. I often get a feeling of like real heaviness in my hands. It's like my hands just want to like root into the ground. They feel very heavy and full and like just drawn by gravity, like extra drawn by gravity. Sitting up tall feels really nice for me. Some people, you know, they feel kind of collapsed and they lie down. So the different effects on the body as well. That'll be interesting for you with all that you know about the body, and you're are you pretty like aware of your own body, I would imagine?
I would say I am. Yeah. I would say more than the average bear for sure. Just in general, both through, you know, my kind of somatic exploration in the dissection lab, but also as a coach and as a manual therapist, you know, so there's this kind of three-pronged approach of anatomical physiological awareness. And that's both a blessing and a curse sometimes. you know, it allowed me to know really early on, like, so not this past December, but December of 2020, I had a really violent attack of vertigo. That nobody could figure out what it actually was. It was, you know, when I was discharged from the hospital, I was discharged with dizziness, which is not a diagnosis. That is a symptom. So that's like going in for knee pain and being diagnosed with knee pain. You know what I mean? Like, great. But just the awareness of the things that could potentially be precursors to that, you know, allowed me at 3 o'clock in the morning to wake up Alex and be like, hey, I need you to check my eyes for nystagmus. I have a pain in the like left side of my neck. We need to go to the ED and make sure this is not a vertebral artery dissection. So, you know, time is of the essence. Let's like get me to the car without banging me into the door, you know?
And I bet you said it that calmly.
Not that dramatic, but again, I mean, just having the presence of mind to be aware of like, all right, this is what is sort of lining up and this is what it looks like. And let's just make sure that this thing that's, you know, walking like a duck, sounding like a duck and floating like a duck is not actually a duck, you know? So, so I think through that lens, the idea of, you know, kind of having psilocybin on board, there's no question that there will be thoughts about, you know, what's my parasympathetic nervous system doing right now? And actually, as you were describing that feeling of like heaviness in your hands, that was part of what came to mind for me was that, oh, well, you know, without knowing what, if any, net impact psilocybin has on things like heart rate, or breathing rate or anything like, or digestive rate, even, you know, the stuff that's kind of, controlled either directly or, adjunctly by the vagus nerve. You know, what kind of is that bringing up to the foreground in terms of sensory experience? So, because I think that in, you know, in a state of parasympathetic activity where you've got the rest, digest, repose sort of thing going on, if it sends you sort of deeper into that sort of meditative state, and truly, like, even types of breath work can get you into a state where, you know, your hands are tingly or they feel heavy or you're feeling almost, you know, sort of disassociated from your own body, that sort of thing. I mean, just the breath work can be very, very powerful in getting somebody there. And we know just from experience that that is impacting and stimulating the vagus nerve and stimulating the parasympathetic response. So I'm just wondering if this is almost like a, you know, a beeline towards that, that kind of, it kind of gets you there and bypasses some of the need for that like holotropic breath work to get you into that deeper parasympathetic state. So just wondering out loud.
Totally. Yeah. I've done holotropic breath work and other types of breath work. And what I always get is the tetany, you know, about
that? Yeah.
Oh my God. It's
so
the worst. Claws. We're making claws on the video.
Yes. And faces.
And faces. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think yes, a parasympathetic state. And I think it can be a sympathetic state, too, that then triggers a dissociative response, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be the heaviness as well, right? Like if things feel so uncertain and new and like maybe some element of trauma is being relived, perhaps even beneath conscious awareness, it's like somatically being experienced. Because I've had like, I've shaken on psychedelics, like I've shaken from head to toe, like, in ways I never have before. Cause when shocking things happen, I talk the same way. I look the same way. People say like, you're a master. You're cool as a cucumber, huh? I'm like, I guess like, yeah, I don't feel anything. So I must be, but it's like, I'll just, you know, feel it later, 10 years later.
Right.
So I think that in re-experiencing, potentially re-experiencing some trauma that the body or even the mind couldn't comprehend at the moment. And so the system went to dissociation to protect the organism. I think that can come up as well.
I completely agree with you. Having taken people through somato-emotional releases, you know, and just sort of through the lens of the Bessel van der Kolk body keeps the score, you know, situation, particularly in people who, again, we've worked with in the past who have suffered catastrophic injury or illness, you know, absolutely bringing them, kind of focusing them through their minds on the moment that they were needing to dig into further, put down, unpack, whatever the situation was for them, just giving their mind a single point of focus before doing the breath work associated with an SCR, so that they're able to, you know, again, whatever it is that they're looking for, unpack, release, explore, dig deeper into that moment in time that paralyzed them, took their leg, killed someone they loved, like whatever it happened mm-hmm. to be, you know? And I'm not saying that like people murdered somebody. I'm saying like through the through the lens of like an accident, right? So, mm-hmm. Because truly, you know, and this is not something that I need to reinforce with you at all, but when people have an initial very, very traumatic incident, the default response tends to be, we're going to just wipe the slate clean. We're going to put this away somewhere else. And there's more, at least case studies emerging that are suggesting that truly there are these types of experiences that are stored in the tissues of the body. And, you know, looking at that from a firsthand perspective as someone who is simply there to facilitate whatever release or not is going to happen. Yeah, I mean, it really is an opportunity for almost the conscious mind to just retire for a bit and for the intelligence of the body to show up and kind of build a bridge or make a patch over the piece that's missing or damaged. So,
yeah. Does it amaze you again and again how wise the body is? Because it amazes me.
Incredible. Yeah. I mean, I never am bored with that kind of exploration, just, you know, and because we are, you know, it's 2022 and I think that, you know, to a large degree, Rene Descartes did us a large disservice by suggesting this separation between the brain and the rest of the body, to where the idea that the body is kind of like, well, I mean, again, our mortal coil, our vessel, our, you know, something that is substantially separate from us. And, you know, I have been, this is my 22nd year doing yoga at this point. So oh my goodness. Feels like a long time. And I'm still learning lessons every single time that I go. And specifically now, I think I'm more attuned to the language of separation between the mind and the body. You know, rather than saying, listen to yourself and what you need this practice, frequently the language is listen to your body. What is your mm-hmm. body telling you to do? This is me. And so, you know, it's through no fault of anyone's. It's, we live in a Cartesian kind of a, you know, society. And so, I get that that's the lexicon that we're working with right now. But a lot of my, exploration and also my treatment is rooted in reconnecting brain and body. Because, you know, again, one of actually, there is, I'm not going to be able to cite the source, so you'll have to forgive me. But there was a parable about a man and two ogres. And he comes to a cave where there's an ogre sleeping, and he finds that there is a dead man already in this cave. He's living. There's another ogre that sort of shows up at the cave. And the ogres start fighting over who is going to get the live guy, right? And so they start to compromise. And so one of them takes his right arm off and replaces it with the dead guy's right arm. And then the other one says, well, you know, you're getting mostly fresh and I'm getting mostly spoiled. So let's just, so eventually this rolls on until the man who's alive, whose mind is still alive, his body has been entirely replaced with the other man's body. It's horrifying,
whoa,
right?
Whoa, yeah.
but the question at the end of that parable mm-hmm. is that man still himself? Mm-hmm. And my submission is no. Like it, mm-hmm. and that to me speaks to the absolute personalization and ownership and embodiment of ourselves within our own bodies. And so, and that was, you know, something that we used to explore as well with folks when we were at the foundation, which was, you know, So do you feel now that you have an amputation that's, you know, almost a like a really high kind of hip disarticulation, let's just say. So it's the entire leg that's gone. Do you feel like you're missing a substantial part of yourself? Like, you know, how does that? And the responses are varied, as one might expect. I mean, there are some people who, you know, feel like they're incomplete. There are other people who are like, well, I haven't changed. It's just my body that's changed. And so I think there's places where there's room for that kind of Cartesian divide, because again, when you've got somebody who's suffered this level of injury, for them to be able to continue to perceive as whole, despite the obvious missing piece, is, I think, something really interesting and powerful and useful and good, you know? But by the same token, then again, when we go back to the ogre parable, it's like, so, and as an able-bodied outside person hearing these things, it's really interesting to just reflect and think about, you know, what I would feel if there was any piece that's gone is a critical piece, you know, in my opinion. And so if there was a critical piece of me that was missing, how would I reconcile that? How would I feel in terms of wholeness? You know, that sort of thing. So.
Oh, I'm just exploding with interesting responses to make to you.
Perfect.
So one thing I thought of, and yeah, the other is like very heady, so we'll see if we even get there. But okay. So first it's like losing parts of your body, right? In psychedelic ceremony, I feel like I've lost parts of myself that like I identified with, but mm-hmm. maybe it actually wasn't me. And so there's this experience, you know, kind of common trope of like a person's on psychedelics and they're like, I'm dying. And they feel like they're dying, and different ways to work with that. You know, one teacher of mine says like, to encourage the person that a part of you may be ready to let go. And, you know, can you let that part go and let that part die? You will not die. A more radical way of dealing with it. Apparently, one of the musicians in the Grateful Dead was like walking away after a show, and some guy was surrounded by a group because he was like naked and freaking out and tripping on like way too much acid. And he was like, I'm dying. I'm fucking dying. And he was like being really violent. And the musician from the Grateful Dead came over and whispered something in his ear. And the guy just sort of relaxed and like laid down. And then people, you know, what did you say to him? And apparently he said, die, motherfucker. I love that story for so many reasons. But so that's funny. And it's like, I've been studying internal family systems, which it like looks at who we are. We have this true self, and true self is like the self that you're born with, and it hasn't been wounded, you know, even though people can be wounded prenatally, of course, and like the stress of the person, you know, the mother or the person carrying mm-hmm. the baby, like can affect the baby and the fetus. But true self is like the self that's prior to those harms, and harms we experienced with attachment figures or whatever create these like split off personalities inside of us. So different than like multiple personality disorder, as it's colloquial called, or dissociative identity disorder is the clinical name. Different than that, but not so different, because like to give myself as an example, I have a part of me that says, be generous. Be patient and generous, and let this person talk. Like if they want to talk the whole time, then just let them talk. And I have this other part that says like, you're just going to let them walk all over you, aren't you? You're such a pushover. Stand up for yourself, bitch. Like, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. and they're distinct, and they, you know, different experiences gave rise to each of these parts. And so in internal family systems, we try to like listen to them and let them unburden themselves, and we unblend from them and recognize that that part isn't true self, but that part's trying to help me. It just might be at a really different maturity level than me. Like if I was, you know, if I learned to submit to what other people want when I was like 4 years old, the part that tells me to submit is probably like 4 years old. So it's mm-hmm. doesn't always help in a way that generalizes to the situation at hand. So
that's
thinking
very,
about
very, very wise, yeah. though, and mm-hmm. very, like being at the optometrist's office and better one, better two, next one, better one, better two. It just kind of snaps things into focus. Thinking about a lot of people that I love and care about in my life and where they can be so cerebral and compassionate and loving and present and all of those things that you want from the people that you care about most in your inner circle in your life. And then all of a sudden there's this switch and they're, you know, this like self-involved four-year-old. And it's like, wow, because, you know, you've got these wounds that are occurring obviously at various stages in life. And that's sort of where you're hanging out. Particularly in an untherapized, unexplored, you know, just kind of dormant state of woundedness, I suppose. So very, very interesting, very clarifying. So thank you for that.
Mm-hmm. And so that's the more psychological response to what you said. And now can I attempt the more like meta one?
Go for it. Yes.
Okay. So I'm thinking about Descartes and the separation of mind and body, right? That's what you were saying.
Yep.
So another common psychedelic trope is like, we are all one and feeling the interconnectedness of all beings and all things. I was listening to, another source that I'm not going to be able to cite because I can't remember what it was, but if I do, I'll, you know, let you know. But it was like talking about how, I believe it was Abrahamic religions, but just any religion that makes people separate from God or the divine.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just had me thinking about, you know, like people like pray to God or, you know, we hurt each other as though we aren't like so interdependent on one another. And like, it really does hurt me when I hurt another person in many mm-hmm. different ways. So I'm not sure if there's a question or a point to it, but that the disservice of Descartes made me think of what this source was saying is like the disservice of religions that are hierarchical and say that there's this like God above you, you're separate from it or them or whatever. And I think there's a fallout to both of those things, Descartes and the, you know, hierarchical divinity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sort of just like working that through the gears in my head because I tend to agree with you there. And what's interesting is that this has come up a lot actually in the past 3 weeks because I just married a partner who is a very devout Christian. Mm-hmm. And grew up in like a literal Bible study type of church, to where, you know, everything that's contained in the Bible is literal and true, right, through his lens of belief. And so, you know, talking to him as a agnostic, atheist, animist, I don't know. I'm undecided at this point. Right?
Oh my God. You just like described my beliefs right there. Like agnostic, atheist, animist. I don't know. Nailed it. Yes. I'm your religion. Go on, please.
Okay. Perfect. It's one of those things where I think I'm too curious to just sort of discount anything out of hand, but the subscription to sort of one particularly male God to me doesn't quite connect for me, you know, it just doesn't feel, I'm like, that's not my subscription, I don't think, you know. So, but again, with, you know, spending hours in discourse from kind of a philosophical bent, you know, about the things that are contained in the Bible and, you know, how deeply people over the centuries have been affected by those things, either personally or from societal level, is again, I mean, I think that mirrors the Cartesian problem of separation between just the, you know, the brain and the body, the spirit and the body, and then through this other lens, the spirit from God, the power, the, you know, whatever the omniscient thing sort of is, right? But you're right. It's like, that's up here, and then the rest of it is down here. As same with that's up here, and the rest of it's down here. So, you know, you've got like brain as God and body as, you know, just the unsaved or unwashed or the sinner or whatever it happens to be. And so I, you know, it strikes me from this point that there is this kind of like desperation for connectivity and feeling like flailing, because when someone who is really steeped in the Christian faith, and again, this is, take this with a grain of salt, because I'm saying this as an outsider from an outsider's perspective, and it's purely what I've witnessed and had conversations about. But when someone from the Christian faith has basically identified themselves as having been removed from God in some way, they suffer. And the suffering can either be great, or it can happen in small ways through, you know, their own identified changes in patience and personality and, you know, the level of anger that they're feeling and things of that nature, their willingness to meet other people where they are, that kind of thing. But there really does seem to be, in the course of separation, a pain point where there's this struggling to get back to the source, whether that is brain or spirit or God. And any kind of disconnect from that is an exercise in difficulty and suffering.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And not even just personal suffering, but could also be community suffering. Like I'm thinking about in the human disconnected from God or nature too, right? Like the climate change is accelerating and the earth is hurting and you know, extinction and all of that. And then also within a human community, like when one person is disconnected from, you know, God or themselves or whatever, that they can be more harmful to themselves or to other people too, and all of the ripples of that through the community. But staying connected is, it's like a not even, it's more than a daily practice. It's like an ongoing, I don't know. It's like a phone call that never hangs up or something.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. I mean, you know, the way that I would report it again from an outside perspective is that when someone who self-identifies as Christian is sort of like, it's, you know, they're in their Bible and they're praying and they're doing that sort of stuff. It's like they're kind of continuously on the charging dock. And, you know, at that point, it's, things are smoother, easier. They feel better, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, bringing this back into the more earthly realm, I think that when people are really living that Cartesian divide and, it's, you know, again, the line sort of occurs at the top of the eyebrows between me and other, right? You know, I think that that is what also can, you know, I think that may be the reason that we have such an incredible strain on our Western sick care system. Because I think that people are so out of touch with their physical selves that, you know, until they're going to see an outside person about their own body, there's not anything that's showing up for them that would indicate being in a state of unwellness or sickness. Which to me, saying that out loud sounds absolutely insane. Like the fact that, you know, that you need to, let's just use the construct of a physical, right? Or a wellness visit, I guess, is now it's called, because you can't reimburse for physicals when you're over 65, which I didn't know.
Oh my God.
It's crazy. I know. Yeah. So it's a wellness check now at this point in time. But yeah, I mean, to have someone say, you know, you've got this going on, you've got incredibly high blood pressure, you're at risk of a heart attack, you have cancer. I mean, and I'm not saying that everybody should absolutely without fail be able to detect, you know, foreign bodies that would seek to hurt them. However, some indication of things are not normal for me, you know, I would think would be really, really helpful and probably would lessen the rate of advanced disease in the society, you know, quite honestly. If people were able to just sit with their entire selves for 10 or 15 minutes a day, whether that's through leaving all of your devices at home and going out into the world to get fresh air and sunshine on your face during a walk, I mean, at that kind of base level, to, you know, integrating in some sort of a meditative practice or like a yin yoga practice or, you know, something along those lines, I think would go a really long way towards just, you know, an early warning system. But again, you know, so in the same way that when we are separated from source is what I'll just kind of call, you know, the construct, there's inevitable suffering, struggle, anxiety, and that sort of thing. In the same way that we are disconnected from self, physical, there's bound to be that level of, you know, sickness or anxiety, particularly when we are living in bodies that are advancing through stages of disease without us, finger quotes, knowing.
Yeah. I think it's not just that body awareness that can be, allow us to stay like healthy and self-aware, but also mental and emotional awareness of oneself too.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you, like, I was wondering about treating people's bodies when the people have trauma, they've sustained trauma to their bodies, but it was also emotionally traumatizing. I mean, you mentioned, like, was it SEM?
OSER, so somato-emotional release. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm just like curious. I know we don't have that much time, but could you speak a little about that?
No, it's okay. So that is different body to body, as you could probably imagine. I mean, there are some common things that happen, and this is going to be purely anecdotal. So for any empiricists, I apologize. but you know, through the concept of which, you know, I tend to subscribe to this very heavily, that the brain has a map of the body, right? That at any given moment, there may be spots that are dark, meaning lacking resource, or very bright, meaning, you know, that may be a pain point or something that you're acutely aware of in your waking hours. So more often than not, what I encounter is when someone has, you know, suffered some sort of, again, catastrophic injury or illness, they're in a post-acute phase. The area of the injury or the illness, often is dark on the body map. Often if I'm sort of around things, you know, and I'll be feeling either different releases or some neural firing or things of that nature. And I'll ask them, did you feel that? Are you feeling okay? Is everything all right? I would say maybe 60% of the time, the response is, I can't feel anything that you're doing. Yeah. So, and now the technique that I've sort of graduated to using is very gentle by design. So it's not the, you know, kind of dagger fisted, practice of my early days, but so even that, you know, all things being equal, I'm typically providing enough pressure or sense that there should be some sort of a response. And as I said, I would say about 60% of the time there isn't. And so, you know, I think this sort of goes back to the discussion that we were having about how, you know, there's almost like a stopgap measure or safety mechanism, if you will, that's sort of put in place there, because that injury is associated with a traumatic event, that just allows the person to keep away from that like right. literally through the no sense, no feeling, right, kind of lens of things. And so, you know, the goal is always to work with the person towards their goals and tolerance, you know, because initially when I set out doing this, somewhat more naive, it was, well, let's just restore feeling to everybody because that's what they should want. Right. Wrong.
Right. Yeah.
So, you know, it certainly, there were some humbling lessons along the way that taught me just, you know, about sensitivity to people and where they are and what they needed versus what I thought as the outside practitioner that would benefit them the most. But how the fuck would I know that? So, and that again is just speaking to the intelligence of the organism, that is in front of you, because that really ultimately through somato-emotional releases or any kind of body work, absolutely 100% and unequivocally has to be the guiding principle. It's the organism. It's not what you as the outside practitioner are trying to dig for or get at or accomplish. You have nothing to do with it. It has everything to do with the individual that's either in front of you, under your hands, however you want to put it.
Right, right. We are all the best authority on our own healing and journey and needs.
Yes.
Even though sometimes I've fucked it up and I thought I needed something and I needed something else, but I needed to learn that. And that was what was needed at that time. And then like bringing those needs and those feelings to a practitioner who can help us move toward those goals is, because it's hard to do it alone too. It's right. Like has to come from me, but I can't do it alone.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But I mean, also that just speaks to the absolute dire need for solid self-advocacy when you're in front of any practitioner, whether it's, you know, a psychotherapist or a manual therapist or a physician or a surgeon or whoever it is that you're going to see for whatever it is that you're trying to fix. You need to be able to self-advocate, because if that practitioner that you're seeing is smart, they will listen to you. And if they're not listening to you, it's probably time to seek another practitioner, because there's plenty of them out there and, you know, infinite number of monkeys, infinite number of typewriters kind of thing. Like you're eventually going to find somebody who's going to respect what you're saying. So, yeah.
Well, I want to be respectful of your time. It's 2 after the hour. So is there anything else that you want to say or?
No, I think this was very fruitful. So thank you for making time in your calendar for me twice. I appreciate your patience with me still not knowing what time zone I'm in. So thank you.
It's, you know, it's because your heart is on the East Coast. I get it, you know.
It totally is. It totally is.
Oh. Well, I miss you so much, and I'm so glad that we're back in connection. And yeah,
absolutely, yeah, I miss you too, and I'm really, really excited to see, you know, what sort of comes out of this potential project with Michael and those guys and that kind of thing. Just you know, because I you are so capable, and like I said, I think that, you know, the more Leah that we can get into the world, the better off everybody will be. So, but yeah, just being able for you to have another platform to shine your light, is very an exciting prospect for me. So
thank you, Gina. Yeah. I look forward to it. I knew I had to go back to Texas. I knew it. I just didn't know why.
Surprise.
The Psychedologist is Consciousness Positive Radio. Find us everywhere podcasts are hosted. For more information, visit us on Facebook or online at thepsychedologist.com.